Okay, so it is, it's great to be here, and it's, just tragic that I couldn't be here for the first 2 weeks. I'm not in that Californian, relaxed, mellowed, state of mind. But I'll just try to do my best. So, let me talk about energetics and signaling and development. And I know that, I don't want to, I'm going to overlap, say a little bit about what, go over what Jonathan talked about, just because, I also, for my own benefit, because I'd like to talk to people here, and then also want to talk about, say something about molecular machines. So it's basically two stories. And let me just introduce you to my lab. I mean, we're interested in what I call the dynamic morphology of cells. And the general question is, how do molecules build and move structures that are much larger than molecular dimensions? And, of course, cells, they're active materials. There's a constant flow of materials and energy through cells, and I think that's really that's a very interesting and open question about how much energy and materials you really do need in order to maintain these, in order to be able to maintain these structures. So, as I said, I'm going to talk about two things, about the zebrafish and then molecular motors. And, please just butt in if you want to ask a question, or tell me to go to the next slide if you've already seen it, if it's boring you. Let me just start by saying something about development. I'm sure that you've all seen this movie. I watch it over and over again. It's just so awesome. But the thing that you have to really appreciate about development is that even though it's just impossibly complicated, it's actually incredibly robust and stereotyped process. And actually, it really is a fantastic system, experimental system for trying to understand how cells work, just because it is so repeatable. And I do think that there's a great opportunity for real physical by physical understanding of development. And one question that we've asked is, how much energy is used during these processes? And Jonathan has done this, beautiful work on this cleavage stage, and that's where the cells, it's the first 10 cell divisions, where the number of cells goes from 1 to 1,000 without changing the volume of the embryo. So it gives you it's a great system for looking at the energetics required for proliferation, but not for growth. And you saw this before. This wacky experiment where he puts the embryos into the isothermal calorimeter, and he measures the heat. And we'll just expand on that. And what he finds is that the embryos, it's exothermic, so they're releasing heat into the bath, and there's a certain amount at the beginning of the experiment, a certain heat being dissipated. And the remarkable thing, so let me just say the units here. This is per embryo, this is nanojoules per second. But what we can do is we can convert that into equivalent ATPs, because we know what the enthalpic energy associated with ATP hydrolysis is, and so we can convert the heat measurement into an ATPase measurement. And these this unit here of micromolar per second of equivalent of ATP, well, since there are since there's about one on the order of 1 millimolar of ATP in a cell, this corresponds to a turnover of about the cell concentration of ATP every minute. Okay? So it's interesting to note that. It can go much higher than that, but that's what it is here. And this basal rate It's really amazing that when we went and looked up, Michael Lynch's paper, it's really amazing that this basal rate basically comes straight out of his calculations or his tabulations from many, many different types of cells and what have you. And it is, it's really absolutely awesome. And the other thing is that this value, it's very similar to what people have called the basal metabolic rate, defined by West and people like that, and Kleiber's law and all of that. But for organisms on our kind of scale, it corresponds to about 1 watt per kilogram, and that's very similar to this basal rate again. So it's really a universal, really a kind of universal energy cost. And I think, I think that's very, very interesting to think about where all of that, where does that come from? Okay, so there's the basal rate, and then there are these two other components. There's this increasing trend, and there's the oscillations. And we've spent a lot of time thinking about the oscillations, and I was going to go over that briefly, what we're thinking about that. But most recently, we're trying to figure out what this increasing trend might be, and I'll tell you what our thoughts are there. Okay, so here we've got the trend and the oscillation, and the oscillation is it has a period of about 15 minutes, and that period is very similar to the period of the cell cycle, and it's true, the oscillations are synchronous with it. They're the cell cycle. Okay, so the question is, what is it that's happening during the cell cycle that's going up and down and generating more heat during one phase of the cell cycle than the other phase of the cell cycle? And Jonathan did this incredible experiment that showed that this oscillatory component does not depend on all of the things that we would have thought were contributing to heat during the cell cycle, like DNA replication or mitosis or cell division. And the reason is that if he adds the microtubule poison nicotizole, then what happens is that cells, the DNA fails to duplicate. So here we are at the, I think, the sixth or the seventh cell cycle. Here are all of the condensed chromosomes. But if you add nicotizole, then at the two cell stage, you just lock it in the two cell stage here.
And when you add nicotizole, does that have to do anything to the baseline?
Oh yes, I'll show you that. I'll show you that in a minute. Yes, exactly. And so you block replication, you block mitosis, and also you block cell division, because here are the outline of the cells, and basically you have blocked cell division as well. So and so despite having blocked all of the major events that take place during.
Can I ask a question too?
Yeah, sure.
So for sure, replication costs something, and I can't remember if you and I have talked about it before, but DNA replication, if you convert it into micromoles of ATP per second, I mean, it should turn out that it's small compared to the amplitude of the oscillation.
Yeah, yes, and we're very influenced by the Lynch and Marinoff paper and making all of those calculations. Exactly. But when we went into this, we were completely we were completely naive about what might be going on. And but what you see is the oscillations continue just fine. And so it's not so-called S phase, that would be the synthesis phase, or M phase, that's the mitotic phase. And also the phase of the heat does not match either the synthesis phase or the mitosis phase. So here is the oscillation. Here are cells that have been taken out at these various phases. They've been stained with Hertz to be able to visualize the chromatin, and the peak of the heat corresponds to, sorry, it's been cut off for some reason. It corresponds to somewhere in between S phase and M phase. Okay, so it's not either replication or cell division. So, you know, as I say, that it can't be produced by DNA replication or mitosis. And when you do the calculations and you say, well, how much would you need in order to do that? It's all very well and you can do that, but the point is this. If it were S phase or N phase, then it would be increasing exponentially during the cell cycle. So in the first, you know, so after 1,000 divisions, it would be 1,000 times, the amplitude of the oscillations would be 1,000 times larger. You know, we only thought of this after we'd gone through all of the hard work and thinking about it and stuff like that, but it's just very obvious it just can't be that. And that it's that we have to look for you know, have to look for something else. And you know what we think it is we think it's the biochemical reaction that drives the cell cycle. It's a cyclic. It's the CDK1 kinase that is phosphorylating targets, and there's a lot of kinase there. There are a lot of targets, a high activity enzyme, and we believe that that can account for, you know, at least within an order of magnitude of the amount of heat which is being dissipated during this process.
Surprising that inhibiting replication or mitosis does not prevent this oscillation. So I would have imagined that this cyclin kinases were coupled to those processes somehow.
You know, you might have thought of that, but the cell cycle is generally, so except in these cells, the cell cycle is a, you know, really defined as a series of checkpoints that, you know, you do something, you wait till you, like, you replicate your DNA, you check that the DNA has been replicated, you go on to the next step, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, as it's been defined, you know, originally in yeast, I mean, probably was done in bacteria, you know, the yeast is the one which, you know, I'm thinking about. That's how it was teased apart by looking at mutants that blocked the checkpoints, and you could then put together the cell cycle. But this, in these early embryos of free amphibia and fish and what have you, it seems that the logic is that you want to develop as quickly as possible. And so you just have a clock that just runs, and it runs, doesn't matter whether things are keeping up, whether division or anything like that is keeping up, and it just goes on its own. And it's telling everyone what to do, but it's not checking that they're actually doing the right thing.
That would imply that the cell cycle is an oscillator by itself.
Yeah, and you know, it's the cell in these, in, you know, in frogs and fish, it is an oscillator. And you know, it's been modeled by, you know, people like Jim Ferrell, but also by Tyson and Novak as a, you know, as a oscillatory network, which is, you know, so you know, kind of a, you know, two-component oscillatory network has been able to model it.
Is it possible to check how the amplitude depends on the volume that the cells occupy?
Well, I mean, you're just given that with a zebrafish. You're just given that, but you know, Jonathan is now doing experiments with big frogs and little frogs, and then the volumes are changing.
And then what kind of step is it?
We don't know what the answer to the experiment is yet. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about the oscillation, except that this is a question that we are extremely interested in, and that is, you know, how much energy do you need to run a clock anyway? I mean, do you really need that much? And, you know, very inspired by Nikta's presentation yesterday. I guess she's gone, or she's sleeping in, or something like that. But
she's gone.
But you know, it's really a question of it's very important to ask, you know, these questions about, you know, how much energy do you need anyway? And if you were to look at development and you were to look at this oscillator, could you, you know, could you deduce what the amount of energy is that you need for this process?
Can I make a comment? I mean, I think definitely it's a good question, but it's also important to realize that this is a spatial system, right?
Oh, yes.
So it's not just making a clock, it's making a coherent clock across the whole space. So at some point, we did a calculation where we took the then existing model for this, which and put it in space, and you immediately get chaos. So
you get chaos?
Yeah. So
that doesn't sound very good.
No, that's not very good. And that was the model that existed at the time, and since then there were some followers saying, well, maybe that model isn't right because
I see.
You have to fix it. But there is some issue here that, you know, you can get bad things happening when you go to space. Turing, for example, knows about stuff like that.
Yeah. Have you fixed it though?
It's a paper by Casey Wong, and I think Ferrell is on that.
Okay.
Tuned out the model a little bit.
I mean, Ferrell has a subsequent really beautiful paper on the so-called trigger wave, where he's looking at the spread of mitosis, if you like, throughout spatially. And the question is, that's a very good, interesting question about how much more energy would that add to the whole system if you add a kind of a reaction diffusion type component to it. But I don't know what the answer is actually, but I think it's very interesting to do that. Just so that you stop it from being chaotic, because it's got to be synchronized. Because we know that it is synchronized not only across the cell, but really across the whole embryo, it's synchronized.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Joe?
Yeah.
What are these cells doing metabolically? I guess they need to be lipids.
Yes, let me get onto that. What are they doing? I mean, that's the kind of the basal level of, you could ask, well, you know, what are the cells doing and why are they using that much energy? I mean, we're looking at these oscillations. They're a very small component. These are only a few percent of the total energy that's being consumed during this process.
But maybe that's not related to that, like, do you know, like, if you were to look at the mitochondria in some way, whether it's looking at membrane potential or just morphologically or whatever, during these times, is there much change in them?
Well, this is not what we have done.
Oh yeah, but I was just asking in general.
The cells use oxidative phosphorylation during this process, and I think that, you know, for the whole cleavage division, oxidative phosphorylation is being.
But is there a change in their behavior during these?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is only the first few hours of development. Okay.
Do you know if there's mitochondrial biogenesis, or are they all mom's mitochondria?
Well, yes, well, then you're asking about the maternal zygotic transition. And that is taking place during this time. And the zygotic mitochondrial genes are turning on after something like about the fifth or sixth cycle, and then the rest of the genes are beginning to turn on at the end of this cleavage stage. And that was a lot of the motivation for Jonathan to start doing these experiments anyway, because, you know, in Carla Neugebauer's lab, because she's interested in RNA and the maternal zygotic transition. Okay.
You know what's weird is 3 nanomolars, 3 molecules per micron cubed. So, you know, those oscillations you're claiming, you're going between 2 and 3 molecules per micron cubed. It's wild.
Well, except that it's much, much bigger than that.
It is, but it's not that much bigger. But it's, you know, at most 100 microns cubed.
What, the whole embryo is massive.
Cycling's about
60 nanomoles.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking about sort of on a per cell basis.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So now the other thing we've been thinking about recently is the slow component here. And this component, just coming back to your question, it depends on proliferation, because if we add nicotrizol here, then the then this increase over time is greatly reduced. So this would be the that would be the normal. These are our, the green are our controls with DMSO, and then this is in the presence of nicotrizol. So if you block proliferation, then you you greatly reduce the amplitude of this increasing phase. But it's still some kind of baseline there.
For any perturbation you guys have done, do you see a significant change in the baseline?
Yes, we do. If you add cyclohexamide.
And the baseline is protein synthesis.
Yeah, protein synthesis. Then it really, really messes things up.
Yes. Well, like how much does it change the baseline?
I can't remember now, but you know, it's coming down here.
But it's starting at the same point and then slowly coming down?
Well, if you add it here, yes. Okay. Yeah.
Joe, that means that the global signal, the global heat production, comes from something metabolic. You know, if you stop protein synthesis and you get flak.
Yeah. If you stop protein synthesis, then it goes down. I mean, you know, it's hard to distinguish that from just the cell dying, you know, the embryo dying.
So Alison, the volume remains constant?
The volume is remaining constant for this whole.
It's more constant than this. It's just really constant.
Yes. Volume constant.
Okay. Membrane area may not be constant, right?
Well, no, that's the point, and that is that this increase, it's really very slow, and the number of cells is increasing exponentially, but this heat component, this is not increasing exponentially at the same rate as cell division, because you'd get something like this, a very rapid increase. But rather, it's increasing much more slowly, and that's what makes us think that the slow component may be caused, associated with an increase in the surface area. So basically, you know, after three divisions, then you double your surface area. And so it's the exponential rate is three times slower than for the number of cells, for example. So this is what we're thinking at the moment for this slow increase.
But you could say the main contributor to membrane area is actually the endomembrane systems like ER.
I don't know where the the question is where is that area, that, you know, it's a kind of plasma membrane area, and the question is where is that area coming from, and you know, I think Michael probably knows more about that, have a better idea than me, but what we've tried to do is try to estimate, you know, how much energy would you need in order to increase the surface area of the membranes by adding lipids, you know, and you know, these sort of calculations are very uncertain because it's not very, if you just have to assemble lipids by adding head groups to them, it's not very much energy, but if you have to actually synthesize the lipids, it's a lot more expensive, and so there's a huge range here, and also you need to synthesize, you know, if you need to synthesize protein as well. On the other hand, what we've thought about is the maintenance of membranes, and in terms of the amount of lipid turnover, or the amount of protein turnover, or the amount of ATPase. And I mean, my hunch at the moment is that, the sodium potassium ATPase is thought to use something like 20% to 50% of all cell energy goes through the sodium potassium ATPase, and these cells, like at the beginning, you know, in the one and two cell stage, these cells are absolutely massive, and they have a very small surface-to-volume ratio. And then after 1,000 divisions, the cells are coming down more like a normal cell. So if you were putting sodium potassium ATPases into that membrane, then that's the kind of thing. If the density of the pumps was the same, and then you might, you know, then that would be a plausible explanation for what might be going on. Okay.
Yeah. Nothing is growing, right? So I guess going back to the ER, there's probably no increase in ER.
Don't know. Don't know,
But then I would suspect not. That it's the plasma membrane.
Yeah. Correct.
I see.
It's coming from somewhere, exactly. It's coming from somewhere, but it could have a different, can have a very different activity when it's in the plasma membrane compared to when it was in the ER for, you know, whatever. Yeah.
I mean, you have to measure the heat in the water.
Yes, yes.
So could it be that the heat producing the cell needs to go through the surface, and then the larger the surface, actually you get more heat diffuses to the water, but it's not really the production of heat that goes with the surface?
You know, when we do our back of the envelope calculations, we don't think that there are you know, gradients of heat within these cells, but but you know, the way that this machine is working is that it is clamping the temperature in the bath, and it is, you know, adding or taking away heat in order to keep the temperature being the same. I don't think that that's happening. Okay. So that's what I've got to say about embryogenesis. We've got this this basal metabolic rate. We've got these oscillations. You know, so this is some kind of a universal property, some kind of universal metabolic cost of just having cytoplasm. And we've got the oscillators, which we think is a cell cycle oscillator. And then we've got this slow increase, which we think is due to the increasing surface area. Okay. Yeah, sure.
Drugs to inhibit sodium potassium ATPase?
Yeah, exactly, yes. We haven't tried that yet, no. But that's, you know, that's definitely on the... I mean, the problem with having... you know, postdocs on the job market, you know, they're just lame duck postdocs. You know, you never get another experiment out of them. You know, is that true or what?
So eloquent.
Yeah, it's funny because it sounds so easy, but you know, when you know Jonathan's just at Emble interviewing there, so you know, good on him, and he's, you know, got all of those things. But yeah, that's something that he's got to do that experiment. Absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up. I'll mention that to Jonathan. I'm not the only one that's been harping on him to do that experiment. Okay. Now I want to go back and talk about molecular machines sort of more in my own comfort zone, where I know a little bit more about that. It's very fascinating, the zebrafish stuff, but I'm really more on the molecular machine side. And let me just tell you a little bit about the way that, you know, because I think that molecular machines is the way to think about cell energetics. I think really do believe that. And let me just tell you just some of my thinking about this subject. So, you know, if you take the cell, then the classic way of thinking about the cell is to say that it's organized in terms of organelles. You know, and this is the, you know, that's the cover of, you know, the Bible, Molecular Biology of the Cell, of the Alberts et al. Book. You know, and you all know we've got nucleus and mitochondria and endoplasmic reticulum and the Golgi. And You know, and that, you know, traditionally that has been thought that that's the way that the cell is organized. But I don't think that that's, I think that that's only now of limited interest. It's something that is, it was true in the kind of the golden age of electron microscopy. But the thing is that we're entering a new age of electron microscopy, of sort of molecular microscopy. And I think the way to think about the cell now is in terms of molecular machines. You know, the nucleus has got, you know, polymerases in it. There are ribosomes that are making proteins in the cytoplasm, that proteins are turning over. You know, rather than thinking about the, you know, the ER and the Golgi, I think it's much, much more useful to think about the membrane trafficking and the machines that are mediating electron, you know, membrane trafficking. And just to, you know, because this is, you know, I'm not sure how much this is going to be redundant for some people, but, you know, if you look at a machine like DNA polymerase, it is really a remarkable, it's a remarkable machine. And we actually literally make astronomical amounts of DNA. So it turns out that we make about 1 light year of DNA.
Wow.
Over our lifetime. Okay? And, you know, that's because, you know, because cells are constantly being made. It's actually red blood cells are the main culprits. And every time a cell is being made, it perhaps adds another 2 meters of DNA. So this enzyme is incredibly active. And just want to give a little advertisement to Drew Berry. He's got this fantastic, you know, he's an animator. He's made all of these incredible animations. But here is his animation of DNA polymerase. Here it is. This probably sound.
No. It's Julie.
But, what?
It's Julie talking.
Julie Theriot?
Yeah.
Are you serious? I didn't know
all
that.
Those movies.
Is that right? Anyway, so here it is. The DNA is coming. You know, the one strand is coming in, and 2 strands is coming out. And anyway, so that's you know, that is my you know, so that's, you know, really thinking that molecular machines is really the way of understanding things. And then if we think about things in terms of molecular machines, then energetics and what have you become very, in some ways, a lot clearer than if you were like thinking about a mitochondrion or something like that. Okay. Now, here is my favorite molecular machine, which is kinesin, that at least some of these kinesins, they carry organelles along microtubules. And let me just say what molecular machines are. They convert chemical energy. Maybe I'm not being, maybe not quite general enough, but converting chemical energy into mechanical work, and then the mechanical work is then used to power motility or synthesis or membrane fusion or membrane dynamics, even signaling. And I really think about signaling as, you know, signaling pathways are really molecular machines. They're like an analog computer. You turn the crank. You need ATP or GTP or methylation or something like that, and you get an answer out at the end. A very mechanical type of process. And you know, these molecular machines, they differ from man-made machines. Because, you know, man-made machines, cars and things like that, they use heat or electric fields as their intermediate. But these molecular machines, they use you know, some kind of mechanical conformational change is what they, you know, the way that they work. Okay. Just to remind you that ATP is the currency. You know, for those who don't believe it, then you should calculate it. But the body uses its own weight in ATP every day. It's really one of those one of the most remarkable facts. And So we just are a, you know, we just are burning through this stuff at an extraordinary rate. And as you can imagine, if every cell is using up all of its ATP every minute, then it's got to be replenished and it's going to be turned over, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where that comes from. Okay, so fact or fiction, and you know, this kind of a picture of Kinesin walking along a microtubule, I mean, it is based on a lot of, it's really based on a lot of experimental data. And I want to tell you a little bit about that data from our lab, just in the context of energetics. And then I want to go on to, you know, what we've been interested in more lately, and that is how kinesins and other proteins are affecting the tracks that they move along.
But wouldn't you say that movie is somewhat fictional because of its lack of thermal?
Yes, that is definitely a problem with that. There's definitely a problem. Yeah.
And there's nothing else on the microtubule in this one.
There's no gravity.
And there's nothing else. No. There's a lot of fiction there, but there's a lot of fiction, but there is some facts. And let me tell you a little bit about at least some of the facts. I mean, this kind of picture, you know, it's coming from single molecule assays, which show that a single kinesin is capable of moving along a microtubule, and this is an assay in our lab. It's showing the spot. The green is a GFP tagged kinesin, and the red are fluorescently labeled microtubules. And then, in the presence of ATP, you know, this is in real time. It's using total internal reflection fluorescence microscopy so that we can only look at the kinesins that are very close to the surface that are bound to the microtubules. And what you see is that the kinesins are just randomly coming out of solution. They're binding to the microtubule. They're moving along the microtubule for on the order of seconds, and they're moving on the order of microns. And this kind of experiment is showing that kinesin is what we call precessive, meaning that it makes hundreds of steps along the microtubule before it dissociates. And we infer that because we know that the size of these molecules is only on the order of 10 nanometers or so. So it's moving many, many times its dimension in every encounter with the microtubule. Now, how big are these steps? Well, you know, these steps, you know, first measured by Steve Block, but actually they're quite easy to measure. Here is a bead with kinesin attached on it walking along a microtubule here. This is just by DIC microscopy. And you can track that bead very precisely, and you can see that it's moving boom, 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 boom in a stepwise manner along the microtubule, and the steps are 8 nanometers, and that's the distance from one tubulin diamond to the next. So those aspects of that movie, you know, they're right. I mean, it's moving along the microtubule, it's stepping from one diamond to the next, and we actually even know that it's moving parallel to the dimer and not moving, you know, jumping, you know, it's not stepping to the side, for example, because we can also measure that with these types of techniques. I'm not going to show you that. How many ATPs per step? And that, you know, this is something that we did a long time ago, but I thought I'd just show you that. And I mean, this here is ATP, and this is the cleavage of the beta gamma oxygen, which that's the hydrolysis reaction that creates ADP, an inorganic phosphate, and that gives about 25 kT of energy under cellular conditions, and that's the driving force. And it's possible to measure the ATP hydrolysis rate. You know, basically what you can do is you can throw kinesin microtubules into a test tube, and if you have ATP in there, then the ATP will be split by the motor. And it's a relatively easy, for example, to measure the amount of phosphate that's liberated. For example, a classic assay is the malachite green. It just changes color when it binds to phosphate, and you can measure it quite easily. But there are many other ways of measuring ATP hydrolysis with radioactive nucleotides or other kinds of, and you can separate the ADP from the ATP, for example. So you can measure, everything here.
Can you measure it continuously, or do you have to quench it? It's not quite green, you have to quench
it. This one you have to quench it, that's right. And many of them you have to quench it, but you can also use enzyme-coupled reactions. I mean, I think someone even talked about that the other day here, where you can use, maybe I was thinking about something else, but you can use NAD, I think it's NADH, NAD. I think you talked about that. Yeah, but you can use a coupled assay where you can be basically constantly measuring the ATPase activity using that relies on the, I guess it's NADP, I forget what the exact assay is, but you change your fluorescence and you can just have a constant monitor of the ATP that's being hydrolyzed. Yeah. Anyway, this is a fixed time assay. And then what we can do is we can measure the ATPase rate as a function of the tubulin concentration, then and normalize that per kinesin molecule, and we get a maximum rate of about 80 ATPs per molecule per second at the highest tubulin concentration. And then what we've got to do is we've got to measure the velocity of that the kinesins are moving. And so we measure, we just basically take stuff out of the test tube and look at it under the microscope, and then we look at the speed. So it's in the so-called bead assay. So we can, so here are some microtubules. This is, you just take the goop out of the tube, and then you can measure the rate at which kinesin is carrying these beads along the microtubule, and the speed here is about 800 nanometers per second. And then when you divide one by the other, so the speed is 770 nanometers per second. The ATPase is 88. Per second, so the distance per ATP is about 8.7 nanometers per ATP, and the dimer distance is about 8.2 nanometers, and so you get about one. There's about one step per ATP. And people were asking me, well, what happens if you put a load on it, and we don't know. Basically, that's a much more difficult experiment to do. Could be done, but it's.
So
could be done.
Really take backward steps or fail to take steps.
What's that?
It seems to me like this has always been a question in my mind of how often does it use up an ATP to try to take a step and fail to actually step.
Well, what happens is that with no load, its backward steps are extremely rare. You don't see them. But if you put a high load on it, then actually there will be backward steps. And in fact, if you stall the motor, then what stall means is really it's stepping forward sometimes and backing stepwards, so there's no net velocity. Now the question is, with those backward steps, is ATP being hydrolyzed in the backward step? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know.
And if you fix ATP levels and you put an ungodly amount of ADP and PI, what happens?
We have done a lot of that. So with PI, because already the physiological PI is about 1 millimolar, you don't see a big difference with PI. Maybe a little bit of difference. It's hard to raise the PI above 10 millimolar because a lot of other ionic type things are happening. But with ADP, it inhibits it.
But then does erosion get more random, or is it just slowing down, or is it?
It's slowing down, but it's. I don't know about the randomness and things like that. I don't know that that's really been looked at. But the thinking is that it's been kinetically blocked by, you know, high concentrations of ADP. It's not so much that you are changing the phosphoryl potential, because, you know, the ADP is typically, say, 10 nanomolar in a cell, or tens of nanomolars, and if, you know, if you, even if you increase it to 10 millimolar, you're not changing the phosphoryl potential all that much. Just a few, you know, just a few KT.
And in experimental, you can't, if you wanted to increase it higher, like does it start to become impractical? Again, it's not maybe biologically relevant.
Well, I mean, look, the thing is that increasing, you know, the nucleotides, you know, they're multivalent. So they're, you know, I'm just very nervous about what is the control. You know, what do you, you know, if you increase the nucleotide, say, to 30 millimolar, what is the, and, you know, how do you control against just some ionic effect on the reaction? So we've never pushed it to these very high levels. No. Okay. So one ATP per step, and you know, a lot is known about kinesin. You know, it's possessive. It takes 8 nanometer steps, 180 per step, maximum speed. The maximum force has been measured with optical traps and many other ways as well. And I should say that this force is plenty enough to move a big vesicle. So that picture of kinesin taking that huge vesicle, that's actually very realistic if you actually measure the drag. If you estimate the drag force on it, it's nothing. It's femtonewtons, not piconewtons. So plenty of force, at least if it's not dragging it through a very crowded cytoplasm. The maximum work you would get from multiplying the 8 nanometers by the 6 piconewtons, and that would correspond to about 50% of the energy that you get from ATP hydrolysis. And that seems to be quite... and so that maximum, so this maximum efficiency of about 50%, that's about the same as myosin and dynein as well. I mean, whether you actually get to this maximum efficiency or not is not known, because it's not known how the ATP hydrolysis rate depends on the amount of force that is being exerted, and it could be that there's, you know, it slips a lot. We don't know. But if it didn't slip, then you'd get up to about 50% you get up to this 50% efficiency.
Are there any proteins that you know where the efficiency is bigger than 50 or different than 50%? Because it seems like its efficiency of many things is 50%.
Well, for iron pumps, so for the sodium potassium ATPases, the efficiency is up to 90% plus. It just means it's extremely tightly coupled. So the ATP hydrolysis is very, very tightly coupled to the movement of ions across the membrane. And the same is true for ATP synthase. That is also... you know, it's close to 100%, and in with
but oxidative phosphorylation together is 50%. The ATP synthase itself, yes.
The ATP synthase
but
itself.
If you take the whole pathway, yeah, then it will be 50%.
Is it that low? I'm surprised. I thought it was a bit. I thought it was higher than that. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but if you just take glucose to CO2 and how many ATPs are made, it's about 50%.
Okay.
Using the
yes, okay.
calculations.
Yeah. But you know, this would argue that, you know, cells really care about efficiency. I mean, maybe that's why is it 50%? There's no theoretical reason that I can see that a motor can't have 100% efficiency. It's just a matter of it's just really a mechanical problem of being able to couple things in a way that doesn't slip.
When you say couple, you mean the ATP rates, like the chemical reaction rates is fast.
Well, I think the main problem with a motor is that, you know, you're trying to do something which is paradoxical, because in order to move along a track, you've got to be bound to the track. But in order to move, you've got to let go of the track. And I think that's the hard thing, you know, especially with these little motors. I mean, it's a massive step that it's trying to take.
Good question. What is the size of this motor?
I should have put a slide in. You can get it from the from that animation. Each of the motor domains is about roughly the same size as the tubulin dimers. So, you know, the size is also about 8 nanometers, let's say. Okay, so the actual motor domains, I mean, then there's a longer stalk and things like that. So, but the actual working part of it is, you know, on the order of, let's say, 5 nanometers.
So probably that correlates with the steps it takes also.
Yes, it couldn't go more than 8 nanometers. That would be hard. Now, myosin is a much bigger motor. It's got a bigger lever arm, and so we can actually. There's some myosins that can step 36 nanometers. So they've got very long legs. You know, they're like on stilts.
So this maximum efficient you're getting at stall, and naively I would have guessed that in cells most kinesin are at a very, very low load. I mean, is that, do you think that's correct or not? Or?
Again, we just really don't know, but there are hints that the forces might be large. So, if you look at axonal transport, for example, then, bigger vesicles are moving more slowly than small vesicles. And if they're being carried, if they're being carried by the same motors, If a vesicle is moving much less than the free speed, then that probably means that it's actually generating a lot of force, and it's under a lot of resistance. And in things like the C. elegans one cell embryo, the dynein pulling forces, the velocities are very small compared to the unloaded dynein speeds, and that, so we would say that it's there, the motors there are operating in a force limited regime, so they're actually at high force.
So another question about the efficiency. So how well then is the conformational change understood in those motors? For example, I think the efficiency probably would decrease if there are multiple steps, from between the binding of ATP and when they kind of start to make a move. They're a bunch of consecutive,
there's a recent paper by Ken Dill which makes that, which makes an argument about the advantage of splitting your cycle into smaller, into smaller steps. So already you're splitting it into, ATP binding, hydrolysis, phosphate release, and then ADP release. So you're already splitting it into 4 steps. So, but the argument there is that you can improve the efficiency if you have more and more steps in there. I mean, how it moves is that's a chemical question and a question in structural biology, and I don't want to go.
Just one question. If the temperature were to be higher, would that help in expansion or is it detrimental?
Typically, the speed, the kinetics of proteins doubles roughly for every 10 degree increase in temperature.
Okay, so it's just the Arrhenius.
So the kinesin would just, if you did the experiments at 30 degrees instead of 20 degrees, the kinesin would go twice as fast.
Oh, I see. So it's just a temperature, like a chemical reaction.
It's just like a chemical reaction,
yes. Expression.
Yeah. And, myosins will go 3 times faster for every 10 degrees. So, in the order of 2 or 3 times faster.
So
So this whole motion seems like a very chemical reaction centric.
Chemical reaction? Yeah, of course. Yes. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's chemistry really that's driving it.
Okay.
Okay, good. So that now gives me time to talk about what we've been interested in for a long time, and that is that these kinesin, they do lots of different things. So it turns out that humans have 41 different kinesins, and they're split among about a dozen or so families. And then there are orphan kinesins that don't really readily cluster into families. And these proteins are involved in many different types of processes. You know, they're involved in organelle transport, the green ones, and they're involved in mitosis and meiosis, the red ones. So they have really a great diversity of cellular functions. The one that I just showed you is kinesin 1. It's the founding member of this family, the so-called kinesin heavy chain. And this is the structure. So that's interesting for you. This family of proteins is defined as having structural homology in this black region. It's around about 300 amino acids, and it has a fold that looks like this. It's got these alpha helices and beta strands, and it binds to the nucleotide, and it binds to microtubules. And this this conserved domain, it's very similar to the core of myosin, the other nodule, and it's also quite similar to the structure of G proteins. So these types of motors have presumably evolved out of a protein that was looked something like a G protein a long time ago, and they are they're nucleotide dependent switches. They change conformation when they bind different nucleotides, and the original ones were probably more involved in signaling, and these ones were able to evolve into using that conformational change for motility. That's where they came from.
So, question. So each time it moves a step, is it there's a bond formation and a bond breaking going on?
Yeah, there are many bonds that are forming and breaking. So
every step.
So every step it's binding to the microtubule, and every step it's binding ATP and hydrolyzing and bond, and those steps are all very very tightly coupled to each other.
Also do the steps, sort of the movement in sort of air without microtubule?
I'm not sure that it would make sense to think about it as being stepping without the microtubule, but there's no doubt that binding to the microtubule has a big structural changes on kinesin. So kinesin's been crystallized in many different conformations with ATP bound or ADP or whatever. But when it's bound to a microtubule, it has different conformations still. So the microtubule has a very profound effect on the structure of the kinesin.
Is it known how the ATP hydrolysis is coupled to the motion? Or like precisely, or is that just sort of guessed at?
It's really just guessed at. But it's really a very exciting time because the cryo-EM is now, there's now structures of kinesins bound to microtubules for the first time that have got a resolution better than 4 angstroms, maybe even going down to 3 angstroms. And so now there's that's high enough resolution to be able to see where the side chains are and what have you. So really to get a very, very good detailed atomic picture of what's driving it.
Okay.
Right? That's still, you know, still there's a lot of work to be done to figure out. And it's not, for, it's never been, it hasn't really been worked out for any of these molecular machines. You know, because they're very tricky, you know, allosteric changes that are taking place. And there are, you know, there are, you know, you often think about allosteric changes about a binding here affecting here. And but with motors, you've got ATP, microtubule binding, and then some kind of a lever arm or something like that. So it's between three sites, and that's you know, that has not been understood properly. So okay. So in the last little bit, let me tell you about these depolymerizing kinesins. So these are kinesins that are involved in mitosis and meiosis. So here is kinesin 8, and this is really a very fascinating kinesin, this one. So this kinesin, if you knock it out of cells, then what happens is that the mitotic spindle is larger. So this kinesin, you know, this is in Drosophila cells, but the same is true if you do it in yeast cells or in human cells. So this kinesin somehow involved in setting the size of the mitotic spindle. Okay, and if you think about the sign of it, I mean, it's this kinesin somehow involved in kind of getting rid of microtubules. It's reducing the microtubule length in the spindle. Okay. So we wanted to try to figure out what this kinesin is doing. And we developed this, what we call a depolymerization assay. It's a little bit like the motor assay that I showed you before. But in this assay now, the microtubule is bound to the surface. But now what we do is we look at what's happening at the end of the microtubule. We look at how various molecules are affecting the length of the microtubule.
Sorry, I was writing something. We were talking about kinesin 8.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden you're talking about one of my favorite all-time experiments, but it's not kinesin 8 anymore.
I beg your pardon.
No, I just was wondering if you could tell me the connection.
Yes, because the thing is that, I'm sorry. It's a kinesin 8. Yeah. It's KLP67A. That's the Drosophila.
That's so much to me.
No, you have to realize is that the kinesin 8, they have different names in every species.
Okay.
And the KIT 3 is the kinesin 8 in budding yeast.
Oh. Why did you say so? Okay, thank you.
KIT 3. Yeah. So it's KIT 3, and I'm sorry because I just go from one to the other. It's a kinesin 8. You know, the way that these things work is that these are the names of the proteins that were originally discovered. The first discovery of...
No, it's all good.
So it's KIT 3. What KIT 3 does is it depolymerizes microtubules. They're very remarkable. So here are some microtubules that are on the surface. I mean, I should just say that these are GMP-CPP made of GMP-CPP, so they're really very stable microtubules. They're kind of like the tubulin that would be at the end of a growing microtubule that's stabilizing it in the growing state. So these are stabilized microtubules, and these are microtubules that if you bind them to the surface, they will be there for hours because they're very very resistant to depolymerizing. But if you add this kinesin 8, then what happens is the microtubules shorten.
So cool.
Okay, so this kinesin is what we call it a microtubule depolymerase. So basically, we are thinking about microtubules like you might think about DNA. There are DNA polymerases, and there are separases and nucleases and all of these things. All of those same set of activities also exist for microtubules and for actin filaments as well. And so there's a lot of stuff to do with that.
Do they always get shorter, or is there like a certain length past which they survive even if you add more kinesin 8?
They always just get shorter.
Okay.
And But let me just show you a little bit more detail there. You can see, though, that they're only getting shorter from one end. And the other end is hardly changing at all. And we ask then what end is being depolymerized. And what we can do is we can make these, we can mark microtubules that microtubules are polar structures. One end grows more quickly than the other. And that's called the plus end. And the slow growing end is the minus end. And what you see is that this kinesin always disassembles from the plus end of the microtubule.
So
it's a plus end depolymerase. And if we plot the length as a function of time, you see that the there's a lag, it depolymerizes, and then it actually slows down. But it actually will go to completion. And this here is slow because there's probably some problems with the proteins dying and stuff like that. But the other thing that you see is that the longer the microtubules, the higher the depolymerization rate, or at least this maximum depolymerization rate. And so this is what you get. You get this, it's a length-dependent depolymerization. So long microtubules depolymerize faster than short ones. So we would call it a length-dependent depolymerase.
The point being the slope at where the dotted line intersects.
The slope at the dotted line, yeah. And if you were to plot the depolymerization rate against the length, you'd get the same thing for one microtubule as well.
Too.
Yeah, which we did, yeah. And then the question is, you know, how can a little motor that's only 10 nanometers inside, how does it know to depolymerize a long microtubule faster than a short microtubule? And that really is a very remarkable thing. And this is what Vlado figured out during his PhD. And the first thing he found was that it's a highly possessive motor. And that just means that when it binds to a microtubule, it walks a long way. In fact, it walks nearly 10 times longer than the organelle motor. So this is really, this is a record for the most possessive motor. So very, very, so it just means that whenever a motor lands on the microtubule, it's almost always going to get to the end of the microtubule. And
so that last picture doesn't show any depolymerization, so does that mean this one can walk without depolymerizing?
Yeah, what we're doing is, that's a good question. If this is depolymerizing very, very slowly because we've got an extremely low concentration of kinesin here. And
those look like they're just walking.
Yeah, they're just walking. I'll tell you what it is. They're walking, and every time one of them gets to the end, it only takes one tubulin dimer off the end. So it's a very, very slow rate of depolymerization that's going on. But if you were to, and you know, this is what we've done, is we've correlated the flux of motor to the depolymerization rate. And what we find, and what we've been able to show, is that every time it reaches the end, it takes off a single tubulin at the end, from the end. So this is
that. Uses a lot of ATP.
Yes, exactly. That's the point that I'm going to make. Exactly. So what we think is that the mechanism of length dependence is what we call the antenna model. And that is that the longer the microtubule, the more motors land on it. Because it's very possessive, the more that get to the end. And then the more that get to the end, the faster the depolymerization rate. So what we're thinking then is that if you combine this possessive motor with a so-called low stoichiometry depolymerize, then you get this length-dependent depolymerization.
Yeah. Like, how well does that scaling hold in terms of, like, does it explain? Oh, I see. It has to be with linear. It has to be linear with the length with this argument, which it is according to your experiment.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And if you just look at a single microtubule, then what happens is that it gets shorter and shorter, and then its depolymerization rate slows and slows, and you get an exponential decrease in the depolymerization rate. And it all tests out in a very, you know, we've really tested this very comprehensively.
And does either the processivity or the depolymerization rate depend on, I guess, the nucleotide state of the microtubule itself? Like, if you use taxol microtubules, for example?
It can depolymerize taxol microtubules, GMP-CPP microtubules. If we use both, it can't take it off, and then And then it, you know, and then you get traffic jams and things like that at the end of the microtubule, but you can't remove the. So basically what we're thinking here is that kinesin 8 is using this processivity as a way of measuring the length of the microtubule. So what we're thinking then is that, I mean, how can a little molecule, something that's much larger than itself, then it's pacing out the length, and it's using this depolymerized act. That's the output of this measure. So
might be a pain and say that I just don't think that's the right way to say it, because the motor doesn't know about the length. It's just you've got a coarse-grained, beautiful model that's about
I'm just thinking you've got a little kinesin.
Yeah,
how does it know that it's got something that it's
it doesn't know, but
basically what you need to use that motility as a way of basically it's like pacing out the length of something.
I know, I agree the processivity is the key point really. But it's also the raining down. Mm-hmm. There's more rain the wider you are.
There are many ways of thinking about what's going on. That's all right. This is a form of it's a form of negative feedback, because the longer the microtubule, then the faster it'll depolymerize. So it's antagonizing the growth. And so our idea then is about how kinesin can set the length of microtubules is that there's a growth rate, say constant, independent of length, and then there's a shrinkage rate which is increasing with length. And then where these two curves intersect is a fixed point, and it's a stable fixed point, because if it goes longer, it'll depolymerize. If it's shorter, then the growth will be larger than depolymerization. So the feedback mechanism. And that's our thinking about how it can set the length of spindles and maybe other structures as well. And it's just that it makes us think of
For the spindle, where do you think the plus ends are? Where are they getting polymerized?
In the spindle, the plus ends are they're in the middle here at the chromatin.
So you lock that thing out, and somehow it means that you get longer.
Yeah, they're also and then there are also plus ends out here as well. Yep.
So flies, they have a single kinesin 8, and then that kinesin 8 can shape the length of different types of microtubules, because those microtubules have different growth rates, and that basically slides along. Like basically, the red line is a property of kinesin 8, and then the growth can be a property of the type of microtubule that it's acting on.
Well, we can test this in vitro by changing the kinesin 8 concentration, but also in vivo you can do gene dosage effects, and you can change the amount of kinesin 8, and you get really quantitative effects on spindle length, for example, when you do these. It depends on the gene dosage. If you double it, you get shorter spindles.
I guess my question was more that there are different types of microtubules in the cell.
That need to be
a different length. That have different set lengths.
Yes.
I'm wondering if that's due to changing the kinetics of kinesin 8, the red line.
Well, there are other, one of the things there is that the astral microtubules, they are there are differential effects of, so if you knock out this kinesin 8, you get a longer spindle, but you don't really get all that much longer astral microtubule. But if you knock out another kinesin, then you get long astral microtubules. So these different polymerases can act on different microtubules because there are other maps and things like that are associated with their ends.
One question. Do you have an estimate of what would be the probability of this kinesin sticking and it moving a certain distance and then coming out?
We measure all of those things. So we can measure the on rate, that is, how many kinesins will bind per unit time, and we've measured that. And we also know how many kinesins there are in a cell, in a yeast cell, for example. And so we can estimate how many are binding at any one time. We also know what the speed is. We know, you know, what the rate of getting. So everything is making sense from, you know, when we transfer the numbers into cells.
Is there evidence that the, I guess two questions. First of all, do the kinesins that act as microtubule depolymerases, can they act as polymerases? And if not, is there evidence that the enzymes that do the polymerization co-evolved with the kinesins that are depolymerases?
Yes. I'll tell you what. So microtubules will grow on their own if you give them tubulin. But there are microtubule-associated proteins that we call polymerases, and they make the microtubules polymerize faster. They accelerate polymerization. And among those, so the famous one is XMAP215. It's one that's involved in mitosis. You need to grow very, very long microtubules in a big cell during mitosis, or, you know, as you come out of mitosis. But there's also a polymerizing kinesin. It's a KIP2. It's another yeast kinesin, and it walks to the end of the microtubule and it makes the microtubule grow more quickly. So yes, there's a different family of kinesins can make microtubules grow. So, you know, these kinesins have remarkable different functions. You know, there are kinesins that go in the opposite, that walk in the other direction. They do all sorts of things. Yeah.
What's the mechanism of the depolymerization?
So with the kinesin 8, what we think is going on is that the kinesin 8, it walks along the microtubule, and then it gets to the end of the microtubule, and then it stops at the end. And it'll stop there for something like 30 seconds. And we think that it's because it binds very strongly to tubulin, and it needs the front foot to pull off the back foot. So it just stays there. And then what we've shown is that if you increase the kinesin 8 concentration, the ones from behind will come in and will push it off. So we have this bump-off mechanism for how it's depolymerizing. So basically what it's doing is binding very strongly to the last tubulin dimer, and then another kinesin 8 comes up behind it and displaces it off, it pushes it off the end. Just rips off the last one, yeah. And what we've shown, when we calculate that, we just say, well, all you need is a force on the order of a piconewton or so, or less, in order to accelerate the dissociation. So that's what we think, and that's all based on experiments where we spike in small amounts of fluorescent tubulin and change the amount of the total amount of fluorescent kinesin and change the total kinesin concentration.
Then once kinesin sits on this individual tubulin monomer, then it dissociates.
Yeah, what we think is that it's just sitting on the last tubulin monomer. It can't go any further, and then it gets it just waits there. And then if another one comes down behind it, they'll both come off together. The tubulin and the kinesin 8. That's our picture.
Not sticking together.
Yeah, sticking together. Yeah, coming off together.
Okay, but how long does it then take to dissociate?
That we don't know. Yes, don't know. So our idea is that what we're seeing here is there we're seeing is that motors can do these kind of mechanical computations. So they can use these to measure lengths of various organelles, not just the spindle, but similar things have been proposed for the stereocilia, which are actin-based structures, and also for cilia and flagella. So, Now, the last thing I wanted to say was just to come back to your point, it's expensive. So it is expensive because if you think about it, it's got to, if you want to take one tubulin dimer off the end, then you have to take maybe 1,000 steps along the microtubule. That's going to cost 1,000 molecules of ATP to do that. So so it's expensive. So maybe 1,000 steps ATP per tubulin dimer. And it's very expensive. Now, you can do it in a much cheaper way because there's another protein called kinesin 30, MCAC. It's another depolymerizing kinesin. But this is, kinesin is very different. So here it is. It binds to both ends of the microtubule. And in the presence of ATP, it depolymerizes microtubules from both ends. Okay, but now this is a very efficient depolymerase because it doesn't, this kinesin is not a motor. What it does is it targets the ends through a diffusion and capture mechanism. So it just binds randomly on the microtubule. It has no directed component. And if it happens to bind near the end and it diffuses to the end, then it latches onto the end. And then once it's at the end, using ATP, it can then take off several tubulins from the end in one go. So no cost to get to the end. It only costs somewhere between 2 and 5 ATPs to remove each dimer at the end. And it uses a different mechanism. It uses a curling mechanism. So it splays the protofilaments apart and weakens the interactions between the protofilaments. So this is a very efficient depolymerase. So that just reinforces the fact that this kinesin 8, this length dependering, this length measuring mechanism, it's expensive. The cell is really paying, quite a lot of ATP for this information. And, that's what that was really the point that I wanted to make here is that, how much will cells pay for information? And, we really have no idea. And it's, these motors, there are a way of being able to think about how you might be able to get information out of a system about the size of something. So anyway, that's all I have to say. And here is my group at Yale. So thank you very much.